Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkhang namassami. I can honestly say that I haven't a clue what I'm going to say tonight. I've got a number of themes swimming, possibilities. I think I'll just start by saying what an incredible privilege it is to be in a situation where you have the chance to share your understanding of the Dhamma with others. And normally tonight is a very small group here tonight, and there's the bike pilgrimage, just basically the resident community and a few others, but it's a very small scene. And from one perspective, you would think, well, it's not that big of a deal, just kind of say a few things, something just to encourage everybody, and that's the end of it. But then just recently we had a former army soldier who was deployed in Iraq and was sharing how he was listening to our Dhamma talks while he was stationed in Iraq, and he was given a certain amount of solace from that and encouragement. And it's just kind of remarkable to think. You don't normally think, you know, just giving a little Dhamma talk here in Redwood Valley to a dozen monks and maybe a dozen lay people, and you think, you know, maybe a few people out there in the cyber world might be listening, but you don't think just how far-reaching it can be, and actually how impactful our words can be, and the utterance of a word can be for good or for bad. Really depends. It's certainly no guarantee that just because your words are broadcast that they'll be valuable or beneficial. It's an enormous privilege and a sense of opportunity, a real desire to honor the Buddha's own intention. So you just think about this, you know, when he taught the Dhamma, and he had a very specific teaching, and you know, never mind the question as to whether or not I'm a justified heir of that teaching or not, but he existed and he taught something, and he wanted that teaching to be maintained and preserved and practiced. So now, as I reflect on who the Buddha is and my my deep respect for that being who walked and talked and sat and wandered across India and did everything he could that beings, both beings alive then and future generations, beings that he could see and that he couldn't see, just the beings would benefit and be freed from suffering. That's such a noble and beautiful thing. And to somehow be part of that lineage and to as it were, be representing him. Well, you know, it's very easy to think, who am I to be representing the Buddha's teachings? If you want to know what the Buddha taught, then you should don't go through me, but go through the suttas or the Kruba Ajahns, the ones who are fully enlightened. But that's feeling. That's just the way it feels. And I think another side of it says that well, there's, you know, I've been a monk for so many years, 20 years now, and this is my 20th reign, and there's been some experience had and lessons that I've learned and mistakes I've made, some big, some many small, few humongous. And I regret those, but I you know, carry on. And to the best of my ability to try and kind of reestablish myself in that which I actually really believe and trust is true and valuable. And it's not just that, you know, someone, we were saying at tea time today, there's this discussion, and someone was saying how they're studying, say, different religious, certainly different strands of Buddhism, perhaps at university or at school. And recognizing how there's so many different traditions and lines and lineages and teachings, and each teaching basically has their history, and they have their own sort of Kruba Ajahns in that tradition, and they think that they have inherited the right teachings, and they want to, I'm carrying on from what was said a little bit, but like they want to maintain the integrity of those teachings and so forth. And it's I was just reflecting what a challenge that is. Say when you study Buddhism from sort of an objective perspective. And in terms of looking for truth or for the Buddha's teachings, I think a starting place, a place where we can start, is there anything that we can say, okay, this is something I'm willing to just give myself to totally? Is there anything that we have like that we can just say? Like, for instance, the scriptures. Am I willing to say this is the word of the Buddha? And if you read the suttas, sometimes it's like, well, wait a minute, I don't really get it. It seems like there might be a little contradiction there somewhere, or it's like, well, how do you know that the way that this is phrased, it doesn't really make sense. How do you know? It's sort of spoken, it's sort of recorded in a third person, and it's like, and then so-and-so thought this. And you say, well, wait a minute, who's saying this, and how do they know who thought what? And it can give rise, if you're looking for absolute certainty in like a historical document, it will always lead to doubt, because whatever you use to guarantee the authenticity of something, you can always question that further through rational inquiry. And it always will be on shaky ground. So is there anything that we can say, right, this is something I'm going to give myself to completely, this is something I trust? Well, how about a teacher? You know, have you found a teacher that you trust completely? And I just want to say from my own experience, this is another challenging thing. I mean, you see a teacher and you think, well, gee, you know, is that... Maybe at first you hear the word enlightenment and you see a teacher and you say, right, this teacher clearly, you know, is enlightened. I remember there's this one teacher when I was a junior monk, totally convinced, you know, Arhat, this is a man who knows the Dhamma. And absolutely confident in that. And then as the years went on, sort of stopped studying him, and I can't really say I lost faith in him, but I just, it became a, no, I don't think so. It's he doesn't have it quite right. And kind of turned to somebody else. And there's that whole rumor mill that's kind of like in Thailand. You have this, what teacher is enlightened and what teacher is a stream enterer and what teacher is a anagami. And everybody kind of goes and tries to see the Arhant teacher. And then a few years later, there's somebody else somewhere who's like an Arhant teacher, and you go and see him. But then a few years later, it turns out he's Parajika. you know, I've been through this, and I don't feel that I'm not trying to, you know, intentionally disillusion you or kind of make you feel like, you know, the system is corrupt. But I think that we should understand that this is when you set up an ideal in somebody, that's your own creation, and you're projecting perfection or sainthood onto somebody, and it's very likely that that projection will crumble at some point. I mean, this, you see this in like our tendency in the Western society to create celebrities, and you kind of you build them up, and they're great, they're fantastic, they're brilliant, and then they do something, you know, that's like there's some tape has been revealed of this person online, and suddenly respect, and everyone's kind of, this person's a, you know, they just kind of completely rip the person to pieces. And both extremes were just, you know, you just get a fragment of a person's life, you get a few ideas to what, maybe an interview or two, and he puts out a good movie or a good song, or then you create a hero out of him, but really you don't know the person. It's just media fabricating something. And then when he or she falls down, then it's just the media fabricating something else based on negative rumors. But really, the inner workings of that person, you don't have a clue. Not the faintest idea. It's a complete fiction that we occupy ourselves with in the Western, modern society. So sometimes with teachers, it's hard to say, to put our faith in teachers, because you never really quite know if the person knows exactly what they're talking about. So what can you put your faith in? What can you trust? And this is where it's like, there's certain principles that, but the thing is, that makes it so magical. These principles are so part of the Dhamma that the Buddha taught, that I'm willing to trust the Buddha's teachings in this. But these are certain principles that I have that I feel very confident about. So one is harmlessness. That's a principle that it can't be wrong. I'm willing to spend this life to the best of my ability to be harmless. Now that may not save the world, it may not, I don't know what the result of that will be, but I do know one thing, is that it's harmless. And that's not a small achievement. If you can not harm or bring suffering to any being. There are so many people who are trying to do good things in a whole bunch of different ways, and many of them very wonderful, I'm sure. But the ambiguity there to me is it's uncertain. You know, how many wars have been fought by people who thought they were doing something good? It's just a simple example. Just another principle is like truth and inquiry. I wouldn't trust a teaching that wouldn't encourage inquiry, that encouraged simply blind belief. That's a principle that I could never trust. So what I'd like to just suggest, what it comes down to, is these simple qualities of kusala and akusala. What do you feel? What do you trust? What do you intuit is wholesome? What do you trust? What do you feel is good? And you may not have a clear answer for that. But I think if you were to, say, take the scriptures, the Buddhist scriptures, the Theravada scriptures, the Pali scriptures, you would discern therein a force embedded within the teachings that is encouraging, even just almost apply, almost, it's almost like it's almost like a program. You almost sense that the whole teachings are designed such that once you start exposing yourself to them, they are going to encourage you to cultivate the wholesome. They're going to expose you to perspectives that feel true, that feel right, that feel meaningful. And I think that's something we have to develop a sensitivity to, is to that smell, that feel for what is wholesome. And the brightness, the sense of ease, the sense of, you know, this can't be wrong, this is blameless. It's, at the very least, it's blameless, and it might be profoundly valuable, which that is my faith. But what I can say is more than faith, although I wouldn't say certainty is a tricky subject, but that it's harmless. And that I will also say this, that whenever I cultivate a wholesome mind state and I make a choice between that stream which is going, say, in a direction which is self-centered or selfish or lazy or simply uncaring, or if I go the other way, which is bright, which is kind of more energetic, caring, interested in truth, interested in love, in sharing, that's got a feel to it which feels right, it feels healthy, it feels peaceful, it feels complete, it feels blameless, it feels good. So it does seem that, like in our life, that there are these, as it were, streams of action, say the wholesome and the unwholesome streams, and probably hundreds and thousands of sublets and substreams and rivulets. But there are these two primary different streams that we seem to oscillate between, the wholesome and the unwholesome. And once you can get into either one of those streams, it seems to trigger associations and memories and intentions and values and aspirations that don't seem to be arisen when you're in the other stream. I'm amazed how when I'm in the wholesome stream, there's such a burning desire to be loyal to the Buddha, to do what is right, to do what is true, to say something valuable and meaningful, and to just so want to settle into a steady, calm, persistent application of mind which is going to be beneficial for myself and others. And to make a difference, such a desire to make a difference. And there's a whole stream of associations associated with that. Like I can remember as a child watching, what was that TV cartoon? It was a cartoon at Christmas time that I just would watch every year about this statue in Denmark or something. And some statue in town, a golden statue that had these rubies for eyes, and it could see everyone in the town. It was like in the 1700s. And this little bird befriended the statue. And the statue could see all the suffering of all the people and the hungry people in the village and the the homeless. And the bird would say, or the statue would say to the little bird, take my, rip off a piece of gold off my shoulder and drop it off at such and such a house because they're hungry. And the little bird would do this and come back, and then the statue would say, now take the piece of gold off my ear. And this would go on and on and on until the statue was just gray and ugly. And the bird started to grieve. It was like, this beautiful statue, I loved it so much, and it's just getting uglier and uglier. But the bird loves the statue because it's so caring. And finally the statue says, okay, now pluck out the ruby out of my right eye and deliver it to so-and-so. And then he says the same thing with his left eye. So now the statue is blind. And the bird, again, just loves the statue. And finally, the town, they see this statue, and it's just kind of getting rusty now, and it's ugly, and the gold has all disappeared, and they hate it. They say, what an ugly statue. Let's just melt it and see if we can recycle it somehow. So they throw it into the fire, the furnace, and the bird, just as they close the door, the bird kind of flies into the furnace with it. and what emerges from the furnace is a little heart of gold. So, okay, it's a little bit corny, but the point is, I was like 4, 5, 6, and I watched it every Christmas, and it was my favorite. I couldn't wait to watch this cartoon. Okay, so what am I getting at? So there was that, and then there was like this book, The Little Prince. Remember that book? Everyone's probably read that book, The Little Prince. And then you grow up, and then eventually you watch this movie, Gandhi, and you start listening to Bruce Coburn. And there's this whole thread of connected events, and it all ties together. There's actually a thread, there's a continuity that's taking place. And that's not unrelated to this aspiration that now when I'm in the wholesome stream, that's there, that's partly there, and it's all these different events are conditioned it. Now, at the same time, when I slip into the unwholesome side, I remember, you know, people here have heard me talk about my passion for the Rolling Stones and different sort of maybe the darker side of life that kind of indulged in as a teenager and friends that I would hang around with back in high school that were not so wholesome and like a whole different thread of my being that was completely or seemingly unrelated to the wholesome side. And it's just this other thread, and it's got its whole list of collection of memories and intentions. So I think sometimes when we feel it's like separated from what is good, it can feel really despairing because it's like we always seem to, whatever state we're in, we turn it into a self. So it's like if we're going through a difficult time and we're not in that wholesome stream, we despair and we feel somehow it's me that's not in that stream. And we forget that that stream is very much a part of our being and there's momentum there, even if right now we're temporarily disconnected from it. What we have to do if we feel disconnected from it, from that wholesome stream, we have to make effort to get back into it. We have to try. There's certain inroads to kind of get into that, and say generosity, sharing with others. It's a wonderful way to get back into that stream. Because it's that stream, if we have any hope of realizing Dhamma, it's going to happen in the context of the wholesome stream. It's not that in us which is unwholesome, which is going to realize truth or freedom. So the purpose of listening to a Dhamma talk then is precisely this. You know, the speaker is to, to whatever extent he or she can, is to provide a perspective for all of us, where we feel free and able to kind of move into that the kind of wholesome stream. And to realize that it's something that we can do, but it's also something we have to do. That this is a very, you know, this is life. This is our one life. That we were born into this world, and we have a very short time here. And it's the clock is ticking, and it's like we're like a book, and the book is closing on us. The space between birth and death is just getting progressively shorter with every passing moment. And we should, you know, reflect on that and use that as a kind of an impetus, a kind of encouragement. An encouragement to realize that this isn't a game. And yet at the same time, we also have to look, okay, so what does that mean to be in the wholesome stream? I mean, arousing a sense of urgency, does that help you get into the wholesome stream or not? I mean, for some people, if you reflect on the shortness of life, you just start to kind of panic, or you start to just feel kind of despairing over the fact that you kind of haunt yourself with images of all the things you haven't achieved yet, and you just kind of are overwhelmed by that. And if that's the way that you're kind of conditioned to think of urgency, then that's something you shouldn't cultivate, at least not in that way. Sometimes, I mean, just I find it's such a valuable sort of skillful means to just sit down and do nothing. Even just the word meditate sometimes just arouses a kind of tension, this feeling that we have to do something. And that can create this sort of a struggle within. Whereas if it's just like, look, I'm just going to sit here. I'm not going to do anything. I have that right, you know. As a human being, I'm just going to sit here and just kind of enjoy myself. That's a totally wonderful thing to do. That's one aspect of the bliss of renunciation. Just sit down and just be happy. Just don't make a problem out of anything. That's okay. There's no reason why you're not allowed to do that. And somehow we think, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to meditate and fold your legs, close your eyes. Somehow it's more difficult than that. You somehow make a problem out of it almost, quickly enough. And we don't have to do that. It's kind of funny how we do that. So you can think of meditation instead of sort of getting your samadhi or, fixing yourself or solving your problems. Just think of it as just enjoying your birthright to just be in your body. You know, there's these eyes, these ears, this form. There's the sky, there's the earth, there's air. Things are okay, you know. Just bring up that perspective and just relax and see what that perspective does to your mind. And, of course, what we're doing in the ultimate sense is we want to understand, in the Buddhist teachings, we want to understand this body. I mean, this is the biggest mystery, you know. this body has come into this world, and it seems like such a hopeless case, like this constant becoming and never being. Like you're constantly moving into and becoming some state, and you never have a chance to actually be. As soon as you decide, like, right, I'm gonna enjoy something, you're eating into your good karma. And you can only do that for so long. And if you get addicted to that, then you can get a real kind of cycle of just where you're just using up your bank account, as it were. And you know, you forget that actually to build up the karmic bank account, the good bank, good karmic sort of down payment or whatever it is I'm trying to say, some kind of good karmic background to your being, it takes hard work and faith and trust and good intentions. So this constant tendency to want to relax, lay back, do nothing, just enjoy your state, that's always going to be the cause of some form of demise. You know, if not in the short run, then in the long run. So you reflect on this and you start thinking about it. This, the human existence, it's a, and this isn't to kind of be negative, it's realistic that there's no form of being that can be fulfilling. It cannot be. There can be no state of existence that is that can be satisfying. Because as soon as it's satisfying, it's like you're eating your cake, and eventually the causes that made it satisfying dwindle away. And then you are back into a state where you have to work extremely hard to get back there. You know, I've said it before, we live here in America, in the West, in a bubble. And it's very easy to forget the nature of the human condition, that humanity has, we've chosen to sacrifice huge portions of the population so that others can live comfortably. The people who are hungry, who are living in overpopulated countries where they're fighting for resources, fighting for land, fighting for food. This is part of the human condition that we just completely can ignore in the West or in the wealthy countries. And it's easy to ignore it. It's easy to completely forget what the human body is conditioned to or subject to. So if we reflect on that, it gives a sense of urgency to understand what is this body? What does it mean to have a body? And where is it that there's a sense of identification with this body? And to do that, we have to reflect. You know, think, what is going on in this body right now? The heart is beating. Food is being digested. So I ate some food today, and that was in my stomach. And enzymes breaking down the food. And proteins and minerals are being incorporated into the body. And none of it knows what it's doing. So the food doesn't know that it's food. Enzymes don't know that they don't know what they're doing. They're just reacting to chemical forces. Blood is carrying hemoglobin around the body. You know, dropping off oxygen to the cells. Movement is everywhere. Neurons are firing in the brain as we sit here and speak. As we think about the future, those are thoughts formed by a brain where neurons are firing. We think of who we are, again, that's a thought that's created through the processes of brain. It's just nothing, it's all in movement, it's all in motion. And we want to reflect on this and so just using what we have, the tools that we have available to us, the Buddhist teachings, the teachings of our teachers, everything that we have at our disposal to arouse a sense of hiriyotapa, a sense of commitment to what is good, commitment to what is true, a sense of urgency, and developing the wisdom to know how to channel that urgency in a way that's actually going to be valuable for us and meaningful. And at the end of the day, we develop the path, and we trust, even sometimes against long odds, because there's no guarantee that when... You know, we say sometimes that, say, virtue leads to happiness, or the path leads to happiness. And I believe that, causally speaking, that only makes sense. It has to be that way. But when it's going to ripen, we just don't know. And obstructions exist. And sometimes those obstructions can be caused by things we've done lifetimes ago. And that's just something we have to accept and understand. And not to be naive about the ease of the path. It's not an easy path, but it is possible. So I think I'd like to close it there and just leave that with you to reflect on, and hopefully that there'll be something in this talk that will help contribute to your ability to be in the stream, as it were, to be in the good, cultivate the good, and be connected with the good, and committed to that, and dedicated to that, and trust that that's meaningful. And I don't think that there's anything more that can be said on that. And if anything that is said that encourages that and supports that and results in that commitment, then those are words that are well spoken and valuable. And those are words that wouldn't be coming from me or anything like that, but those are words that... this is something that we find in the teachings, the Buddhist teachings, through and through, again and again, page after page. It's truly awe-inspiring to me how focused and one-pointed the Buddha seems to be on encouraging. Sometimes it almost seems like I trust everything he says is true, and he comes up sometimes with some very graphic images about the importance of the path. And sometimes it's scary. Sometimes we should not focus on that out of a sense of understanding that it's not going to have a good effect on us. But those are truths that I think we have to eventually open ourselves to and digest and come to terms with. And through coming to terms with it, that's how the path is cultivated. So I hope these words are encouraging, and I'll offer that for your reflection. Namayam namagataya sadhu karam namaste sadhu.